the marketplaces and the grids are rewarding and asking for higher marbling cattle. One of the ways we're accomplishing that is feeding them longer. And so it's almost a case of, we want the premium choice and the prime product, and we will live with some of the cutability issues that we've had before.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Kemin invites you to optimize animal feed quality and safety with our portfolio of solutions. Learn more at kemin.com/AG. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the Feed Science Podcast Show, brought to you by Y-Synetics. I am Wilmer Pacheco, and I am an associate professor in the Department of Poultry Science at Auburn University. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Warren Rushi. He's an extension beef feedlot specialist at South Dakota State University. Dr. Rushi works closely with cattle feeders across Northern Plains, focusing on nutrition, feed efficiency, and carcass quality. And during this episode, we will talk about the futures of carcass weights, soybean-based feeds, and managing cattle in today's high-value markets. Hello, Dr. Rushi. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us today. And Dr. Rushi, could you start by telling us a bit about your professional experience and how the work you do at South Dakota and the work that you do at South Dakota State University?
Sure. I have had a bit of a winding career path. I started off after getting a master's degree. I started out in a county extension position back in the 90s. Did that for a few years. Had the opportunity to go back to our family's operation in South Dakota. I'm a nearly lifelong resident of the state, and our family has we had a custom beef backgrounding business, row crops. We also then had a cow-calf operation, and did that for about a dozen years. And then it became clear it was time to maybe explore some different career options. And at that time, the university was reorganizing our extension system. So I made the switch over to go back to work for the university as a regional cow-calf field specialist. And in another kind of weird twist that happens, I had the opportunity to transition over to the feedlot role and then work on my PhD at the same time. So I earned my doctorate about 4.5 years ago, and I've been in a faculty position since August of 21. So I've had different roles, but really I've been involved in the cattle industry in South Dakota for, 35 years, give or take.
Wow. Yeah, that's very impressive. And it seems like, you have been working in extension for a long time, more than 20 years, right?
It's about 20. If you take all of those different chapters and put them together, it's right at 20 years.
Well, excellent. So I think this is going to be like a really nice conversation that we're going to have today.
Y-Synetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access Y-Synetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
And the first question that I have to you, Dr. Rushi, is that you know that over the last decades, we have seen a steady increase in our carcass weights. And from your perspective, how sustainable is this trend moving forward?
That's a great question. And you're right. It has been steady and near constant, 4 to 5 pounds per year for 50 plus years. I used to think it was going to be an issue on either the marketing or the packing industry or some of those sectors were going to start pushing back. I'm not so sure that's true anymore. I think the packing industry they've adapted their facilities to accommodate larger carcass size. They've also done things to fabricate in terms of cut fabrication and so forth to accommodate that. So, while there's going to be some challenges in that area, I think the upper limit is it's going to come from two different areas. One of them is, as we are making cattle larger and heavier, we're starting to see some more health challenges later in the feeding period, which are now also becoming incredibly expensive when we have late-term mortalities. And the other issue, too, is, the feedlot sector, we take cattle from all over and try to come up with a very uniform product. But the inputs of that are mama cows that function in areas from the northern plains, short grass, tall grass prairie where I live, to the southeast and the Gulf Coast and the range states and everywhere in between. And so there's a bit of a conflict between what the most efficient cow might look like in some of those environments compared to what I would like to have in terms of a feeder calf. So I think those are going to be some of our challenges. Some of that we're going to either decide we're just simply making them bigger and we'll adapt the cow herd, or we're going to adopt some different technologies and feeding approaches in order to accomplish that. But right now, every single economic signal in the feeding sector says feed them longer, make them bigger.
Excellent. And you did speak a little bit about packing plants, and how do packing plants capacities and grid pricing systems influence producers' decisions to feed cattle longer?
Some of it it's probably not driven as much by grids as it is the packing plant's tolerances for heavier cattle. And they've been adapting those grids steadily over time. There was a point when a 900-pound carcass seemed awfully big, and then it went to a 950, then 1,000, then 10.5, and now the grids, at least that we sell on, those heavy discounts don't kick in till 1,100, and some of them even allow a little bit of an allowance and say, well, we'll stand the first few, and after that, we'll discount you. Same thing with cutability, where it used to be really getting punished for yield grade 4s and 5s. Now those discounts are less. They'll stand a greater proportion of fatter carcasses. And as a percentage of value, those discounts are less. So I think some of that is driven by right now the packing sector with short cattle numbers. They're looking at the math same way the feedlots are. The way we accommodate that is we increase output. So we'll tolerate heavier cattle. The other part, too, is the marketplaces and the grids are rewarding and asking for higher marbling cattle. One of the ways we're accomplishing that is feeding them longer. And so it's almost a case of we want the premium choice and the prime product, and we will live with some of the cutability issues that we've had before. The other part that's changed some of it is as feedlots have moved to carcass weight basis and value-based marketing, we've learned that some of our old rules of thumb and paradigms about feed efficiency aren't as true when our output is measured on a carcass weight basis. Cattle don't get as inefficient as if we measure them on a live weight, you bet. They get feed efficiency really tails off fast. On a carcass weight basis, much less so. And we've done some research trying to explore where that upper limit of that carcass gain is, and I'm not sure we found it. And that was taking cattle in a slaughter group average up to 1,700 pounds on steers, and they were still relatively as efficient as they were 70 days earlier.
Okay. So it seems like you are, we do something very similar in, I work mainly in the poultry industry. And if you are just selling a live bird, then feed efficiency is very important. But when you are selling parts, breasts, tights, everything else, then you need to find what is the right combination of factors that optimize those values.
Exactly. And if you look at the beef carcass, portion size is an issue on things like the rib and to some extent like the strip loin. But where, really large part of the carcass value is still in ground beef, and primal size doesn't influence that other than maybe some logistic things at the plant. So that's been one of the real drivers of this. And quite frankly, when cattle feeders are buying some of these, especially some of these bigger yearling cattle that are coming off of grass or grazing systems, the math doesn't work unless we can get out weights up around 1,600 to 1,700 pounds live.
Okay. Yeah. You know, and another thing that we are using a lot in poultry nutrition is soybean meal. And, you know, like that's another topic that I would like to discuss with you. And maybe if you can tell us what is the role that soybean and soybean products are playing in beef rations these days.
So at the moment, it's, you know, it's not yet the protein supplement of choice. It's still heavily dominated by distillers, but we've done some work using some different soybean co-products that might call some of that into question. Part of it was driven by, you know, at least here in the upper Midwest, there's been a real increase in the crush capacity. South Dakota has gone from one crush plant to three, plus a few other smaller expeller or extruder businesses in the state. And so we started out looking at, well, if the soy sector moves to where oil is the driver of value, what happens to soybean meal? Can we use that? And we found some interesting things where we saw some really interesting performance response early in the feeding period compared to a distillers-based control. And then we did a little work using, rather than using the solvent extracted soybean meal, where we would replace some or all of the distillers with either, we've done that with heat treated soybeans that have gone through an extruder. In one experiment, the oil had been squeezed out. Another, it was full fat. What's really interesting to us is when we did a partial replacement, we added another 20 pounds of carcass weight. With a full replacement, we added 30. In today's market, that's $80 to $100 a head. And so depending on that relative difference between distillers and soybeans, all of a sudden there's some opportunities to add value on the, you know, on the cattle side. By usually it's going to require some additional investment on feed. But right now with where the cattle values are, it's certainly something that we think is worth taking a look at, and something in our research program that we're going to be doing more of. We're going to be starting up here in late October. We're going to start up a study on some light calves coming off the ranch to see what those cattle at that growth point, when they're can be so efficient in terms of muscle growth, how they respond to a higher quality protein supplement.
Okay, yeah. You know, like I was in an event yesterday and someone was talking about like soybean meal pricing, and it seems like the price will continue to decrease. It's going to start, it will continue decreasing slowly, but it still is going to decrease. Yeah, so that might be like a really good opportunity for like the beef cattle producers.
You know, and I expect that, especially with solvent extracted, that, you know, your industry and the poultry and then also the swine, they're going to, in all likelihood, outbid us, but maybe not in every instance. Or maybe there's some things that we can do with that feedstuff as a blend with distillers. We think... my colleague, Dr. Zach Smith, and I think that blending of those different protein sources with the different amino acid profiles has some real opportunities to unlock some things in terms of cattle growth. You know, I'm old enough to remember when we didn't feed a lot of distillers grains to cattle. But once that industry took off, it became so abundant and frankly, so inexpensive, especially early on during the ethanol era, that we'll just feed plenty of it, get diets up to 16, 17% protein. We've got plenty. We won't worry about it much. Now, I think there's some opportunities to go back to the future to some extent and relook at protein and amino acid requirements on cattle.
Yeah, and you know, like in other podcasts, I have had like some people that is in more in like in the dairy industry, and then they discuss a lot about like high oleic soybeans. Are you using any of those high oleic soybean products in beef cattle as well?
We haven't yet. I know there's some interest in doing that. Some of that is, you know, as the soybean genetics, I live and work on the western edge of the Corn Belt and the Soybean Belt. And so sometimes it takes the genetic companies a little time to develop hybrids and varieties that work in our environment. So we haven't yet, but that's certainly on our radar screen, is something to take a look at. To some extent, we look at what the dairy industry is doing as a bit of a guideline to say, all right, if they're seeing a response in a high-producing dairy cow, could we see something in some of these beef genetics with the capacity for growth that we have? Also, we're really interested in what might happen in terms of carcass quality. One of the themes, I think, right now in terms of the beef industry, one of the reasons for our strong markets is, quite honestly, we've done a much better job of producing a higher quality product. It took us a while. Our generation interval, it takes us a lot longer to make a change than it is than the people you work with on the poultry industry. But we've been able to add some additional marbling, additional quality, to produce a product to help that the consumer feels justified in paying these higher values to us.
And what about like other soy or soy co-products like hulls, full fats? Are you using those co-products as well?
Sure. Yeah, soy hulls are really widely used in terms of cattle diets, at least here in South Dakota in the upper Midwest. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a creep feed that didn't have soy hulls as one of their base. Same thing with some of our starter pellets. We use soy hulls pretty routinely in our starting calf program. It's a very ruminant friendly feed stuff in terms of low starch but fiber content that ferments well, lets us get a fair amount of energy out of that in a forage based diet. So we use quite a bit of soy hulls already. The full fat, we've done a little bit. As I mentioned, we have one study ongoing right now with using full fat extruded soybeans as a partial replacement for distillers. It's early in the project, but the preliminary results, 30, 40 days into the feeding period look promising. We have not dipped our toe into roasted soybeans yet, but I think that's another avenue that we may explore, because there are roasting facilities in our area, and that would be another avenue that could process these. So, we think this soybean area it could be a really interesting area for us to work in, and it quite honestly kind of fits with what's going on out in the marketplace right now, where it's no secret that the soybean industry could certainly use another domestic market, another domestic outlet for soybeans. And we think perhaps that the U.S. beef herd might be a place to go with some of these feedstuffs.
Excellent. And now, the other topic that I would like to discuss is more like the managing cattle in light of higher, cattle values. So, with higher record feeder and fat cattle prices, that risk management has become more critical than ever. So what strategies do you recommend producers to focus on?
I usually will preface anytime we talk about marketing with I have a picture that I took on a family vacation to a beach, and I say, if I was really good at marketing, if I knew where the market was going, this is where I'd be living, but I'm not. That said, we have seen this movie before. We've seen prices increase, everyone gets optimistic, and then something happens and we'll see a pullback. And so what I would advise people, right, and I am advising people, is it's a wonderful time to be in the cattle business right now. But we do have to make certain we're aware of, now our investment is considerably greater. And so what do we need to do? What does your risk tolerance look like? And then take a look at some of the tools that are available. A lot of our producers here, the LRP or livestock risk protection product has become really really popular. Of course, futures and options as well. I've talked to producers on both sides of that. I've heard them say, you know, gosh, I can, at the price level we're at, especially if you're a cow-calf producer, I can afford a pretty significant pullback. So I'm going to take a little more risk than maybe I otherwise would have. The flip side, you know, if you're buying feeder cattle right now, this is not for the faint of heart. We're working on buying some calves for our research yard, and I thought I had an idea what they were going to cost, and I was wrong. South Dakota is one of the highest feeder value markets in North America, and yep, gosh, these things are not going to be cheap. Which brings to, you know, the other part of risk management is, you know, there was a time when, you know, a 500 pound calf might cost us $900. Now that same calf, depending on the market, is going to be north of $2,500. And so things like health management, some of that becomes really important. Because the impact of a 1% move in death loss, that dollar value impact tripled here in the last 6 years. So I think that part, the production practices, are just as important as, you know, managing the financial risk. They're all of the above, really. This is this business has become, there are a lot of dollars at stake. We need to be prepared for some of these possibilities in terms of what might happen.
Excellent. And you know, like, in your opinion, in today's markets, how should producers think about break-even points and marketing windows too?
Well, the break-even, the unfortunate part is, you know, cattle feeders are notorious for taking the profit we make on one turn and bidding it all into the next one. And I suspect that's what we're doing. Break-evens are high. And so it gets back into that, really, all of these things we've been discussing in terms of, you know, how do we protect against, the black swan kind of event that causes a dramatic drop in the market? What steps do we take? What steps do we take on health management, on cattle that are worth much more than any calves we've ever fed in the past? And quite honestly, this is one of the drivers of why we make cattle bigger is, if that calf or that feeder animal I'm buying, we know it's expensive. We know their replacement's going to possibly be even more expensive. One of the ways I can make the money work is I will make the animal, my output, bigger to dilute out my purchase cost. And we're also in a cheap feed environment, especially where I'm at here in South Dakota, where our, you know, cash price on corn is going to be somewhere in the mid threes, and some markets less than that. There's plenty of forage, and it's relatively inexpensive. All of those things are really telling people, like calves, we can pay. The thought process is I could pay more for a light calf and put a lot of less expensive feed into them and put as many pounds on as I possibly can.
Well, you know, and another really good thing that you bring to the table is a lot of years of experience. So you have seen these situations. It has happened before. So in your opinion, what are some key lessons from a previous high value cycles that might apply today?
Well, the first one is, good times never last, and neither do the bad times. We went through a period where it was a little tough to be positive about the cattle business. Now we're in a period where, you know, it's almost the opposite. What I'm not seeing, at least so far, you know, in 2014, the last time we saw this run up, all kinds of people thought, oh man, we are in a new price plateau. You know, this is just going to be nothing but up. And people got really aggressive on retaining heifers and building up cow herds. And then maybe a year and a half later, it all came back down and bit them. Right now, I'm sensing a lot more caution, which is good. I don't think, you know, it's a rational boom bust cycle doesn't help us. So I'm seeing more caution. I think it's going to take a little time, but I do expect we're going to see some rebuilding of the cow numbers. The challenge is that the barriers to entry just got higher in terms of both capital required, labor. We've had this boom in crop production that took pasture acres out of production. So all those are all some things that are going to prevent us perhaps from getting carried away in terms of cattle numbers. But we've also done, in part by feeding them longer, we've been able to maintain beef production relatively close to where it had been in spite of far fewer numbers. So I think, you know, what I tell the young people that I either work with, either in my extension role or here at South Dakota State, is that be careful. Don't assume that we're going to be, you know, seeing $4+ per pound feeder cattle for forever. Be careful of the debt load. Be careful of the risks you're taking, but and maybe find some opportunities. Is there a way I can grow in this business without perhaps putting as much of my net worth and equity at risk?
Yeah, and you know, like that was one of the other questions that I had, because you know, when the price is good, you see like a lot of people entering, right? So you know, what other type of advice would you give to young cattle producers or feedlot managers during this time that, you know, like you have a high value but also a high risk environment?
Yeah, it probably be the same. You know, I wouldn't say don't do it. I don't want to let fear rule everything, but you know, a healthy degree of caution isn't bad. And what I would tell like a young producer is say, okay, yeah, are there some opportunities to work with some established producers and, you know, perhaps partner with those? Because we've got an older ag producer population that might not want to be calving cows out in the South Dakota in January and February. Maybe there's a young person, though, that is hungry and is ambitious and is willing to do that. Same thing with feeding cattle. Also, it's really, are there areas that other people, are the things that I can do that someone else doesn't want to, that I can make some money doing? So as we were talking before this started, I helped teach our feedlot management class. One of the things I tell those young people is, there's an opportunity to take these smaller groups of cattle, get them weaned, get them started, getting them straightened out, and then repackage them to that larger feeder, either in South Dakota or down the road in Nebraska or farther south yet, that really doesn't want to have to deal with the health challenges of a commingled group of cattle, and they will pay you to do it. And so I think there's some, and there's similar opportunities on the cow-calf side. So I think at this point in the cattle cycle, it's finding those niches, because if you just go in thinking, well, I'm just going to start buying, I've actually tried that, and those writing out those checks gets painful after a while. And so figure out, are there opportunities that, a young person can leverage their enthusiasm, their ability to put in a hard day's work and build some sweat equity to help then build for success down the road.
Well, excellent. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Rushi. This has been like a really good episode. I have learned a lot about, you know, like beef cattle production and, you know, the situation in which you are these days.
Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed being on this program, and thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Well, that concludes another episode of the Feed Science Podcast Show presented by Wisenetics. Thank you for joining us today. Don't forget to subscribe to stay updated on future episodes. And if you have enjoyed today's episodes, please leave us a comment. Thank you again, Dr. Rushi, and thank you, everyone, and I hope you all have a blessed day.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10-an-hour tasks to focus on more $1,000-an-hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.